The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. The role of endoscopic evaluation to assist anticoagulation planning is presented by Dr. Kevin Dolhide.
So it says that there's no disclosures for this lecture today, right? There is a disclosure. Marty lives right down the block from me, and he could only find me and Nate to give this lecture today. So some of the things are, a lot of our discussions today are going to have overlap. What I talk about, what Dr. Nate talks about, what Marty talks about, will be what's going on now in endoscopy and preparing patients pre-endo and post-endoscopy, and what to do about their anticoagulation, which there's so many of them now, it's hard to put all of our heads around it. Recently, I had a case at the hospital, and an old Greek guy, he was about 90 years old, and my partner did an endoscopy on him. Of course, he had a mitral valve, an aortic valve, mechanical valve replacement, and he had just a small polyp in his cecum. And my partner did a hot biopsy on it, clipped it, and sure enough, he goes away on vacation, and the guy bleeds about 5 days later. So this is the kind of complicating things that happen in endoscopy, when to scope the patient, when to give them fresh frozen plasma or vitamin K or some type of prothrombin complex or whatever you need. That's the part that gets complicated, I think, at the point in time when they come into the emergency room. But we'll also talk about just routine endoscopies, what to do with the patients that have been on Pradaxa, Plavix, Coumadin, and whether at high risk. So some of the take-home points would be about decisions to make before and after endoscopies, the routine low or high-risk outpatient endoscopic evaluations and what to do with their anticoagulation, whether to stop it, when to stop it. And we'll also talk about the use of the Coumadin and the newer oral anticoagulants. And then the most important thing, what to do in these patients who are high risk, who have active GI bleeding, whether it's from us doing our endoscopy or whether it's from just them coming in, being on anticoagulation and bleeding into the emergency room. When to take care of the anticoagulation reversal. And patients with, I can't wait to hear about what Marty has to say about patients who've had recent MIs, who have had some type of cardiac event, they have a stent placed, and then they have post stent placement and rapid bleeding, and when to scope these patients, what to do about the reversal. My lecture's gonna be a little shorter, but I think Nate, you and I are gonna have some little bit of overlap because we have some of the same references that we've used. But I think a lot of this stuff will be reasonable to go over a second time, because just going through all these new anticoagulation effects that these meds have on patients is pretty amazing. I want to try to have you guys understand the new approaches to anticoagulation and understand the new reversal agents for GI hemorrhages. Most recently, Pradaxa came out with Pradabind, I believe it is. Praxabind, yes. So these are all coming out pretty rapidly at us, and I want you to try to help understand that. We separate the patients, whether they're a low or high risk endoscopy. Some of these will overlap because patients that come in for a routine colonoscopy might have a large polyp in their colon or might have AVMs that might take it from a lower risk to a higher risk procedure, but we try to put them into the high risk or low risk categories ahead of time. And this kind of tells us which patients we want to stop their anticoagulation earlier or whether we can keep it going closer to the endoscopy time and start it more rapidly after the endoscopy is completed. So some of the high-risk procedures would be polypectomy, biliary sphincterotomies, which again, both of those, you don't know whether we're gonna have these ahead of time in most cases. Treatment of varices, of course, PEG tube placement, balloon enteroscopy, which a lot of people don't do necessarily in all the community settings, and tumor ablation and endoscopic mucosal resection. That's where they go into the esophagus for, say, somebody who has Barrett's esophagitis, where they resect endoscopically the upper level of the lining of the esophagus. Then there's low-risk endoscopies, which, again, these patients that come in for diagnostic EGD colonoscopies might not be necessarily low-risk after the procedure is done, because we might find something more significant with them. ERCPs with just stent placement, not with sphincterotomy. Push enteroscopy, I don't know if everybody's real familiar with push enteroscopy, but it's just, we get these small bowel enteroscopes, so normal colonoscope is maybe 190 centimeters. Well, this would be significantly longer than that, be up to 210 or 220 centimeters. And an argon plasma coagulation, which is what we use just to cauterize the superficial lesions like AVMs, or patients who have had bleeding from AVMs, or post-polypectomy bleeding, we use argon plasma coagulation. The one nice thing about being practicing after 25 years is things have changed so much in endoscopy and therapy. I mean, everything from the stents that we use when we go and do the ERCPs or the sphincterotomes when we make an incision. The argon plasma coagulation is so much better now that we don't have significant post-bleeding from ABCs. And now we have these things called resolution clips. So if I go in or Dr. Nate go in, we see a large polyp or a polyp with a stalk on it. And this is all to help prevent recurrent bleeding after we remove these polyps. So we just put a clip at the base of the stalk that we removed. So things have changed so much and so rapidly that there's a lot of things we could do now that we couldn't do back 20 years ago. So all these anticoagulations that we use, whether it's a vitamin K antagonist, a Coumadin, or the oral anticoagulants, have the risk of bleeding. There have been numerous studies, but just through the experience of working with patients who have been Coumadin, and whether it's Pradaxa or Plavix or Eliquis, it seems like the Coumadin seems to be more of a problem to us, and I don't know if it's more of a problem just from an experience point of view, because they're so difficult to reverse the anticoagulation on these patients. And when you do reverse them, you don't want to reverse them too fast that they have a risk of thromboembolic disorder. So the inherent risk from the warfarin is 1 to 3%. The GI bleeding, when I say represents a common bleeding site, I mean something from like a gastric ulcer or AVMs or colonic ulcers or large tumors inside of the colon. It seems that most of the bleeding comes from the upper GI source and for some reason lesser from the lower GI source. With the new studies out now, they think that the oral anticoagulants have about the same risk, but in just from experience basis, and I don't think it's because more people are in Coumadin, I think it's just that the Coumadin seems to have more of a problem. So patients who are on these anticoagulant drugs, right, and we have to either reverse or stop their anticoagulation if they come in with obviously active GI bleeding. Hopefully we would prefer if these were upper GI sources because those are easier for us to treat than the lower GI sources. If it's a colonoscopy, then we got to obviously have to prep the patient and clear the colon out. If it's just an upper GI or a potential upper GI bleed, then we can stop their anticoagulation and see sometimes how they progress. If they're not in hemorrhagic shock, then we have a little luxury of time. If they are having significant difficulties, then obviously we have to reverse the anticoagulation. And patients like Coumadin, we might want to use either vitamin K if it's not that bad of a bleeding, or we might want to go to fresh frozen plasma. And that'll kind of vary according to how high their PTINR is and whether they can tolerate getting 4, 5, or 6 units of FFP. If they have heart failure, we don't have that option. And then the third option they have is what's called this prothrombin concentrate. And that's varied according to how high their INR and how the weight of the patient is. And all that I leave up to the pharmacist. So I tell the pharmacist what's going on and tell them to dose the prothrombin complex or ask ER to do it. So these patients, depending on how fast we have to reverse their anticoagulation, will make a difference when we decide to scope them. But we have other ways to make this diagnosis too. We have the nuclear red blood cell scans or angiograms. So if you have a nuclear medicine scan, if they're bleeding 30 cc's an hour, then at least we have an option to find out where the bleeding's coming from. And I always tell the nurses, they ask, you know, it's a negative exam for a nuclear medicine scan. I'm like, this is a good thing. At least I can go back to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning that they're not bleeding anymore. I don't have to come in and scope immediately. And then we have angiography if they have decent kidney function, and if their anticoagulation isn't that bad, the radiologist may elect to do the angiogram. Some of these patients that we want to evaluate for just routine pre-endoscopic evaluation for anticoagulation reversal, that would be patients who are just more of a low-risk outpatient without having significant GI bleeding. That's another different approach. I think, and Marty and I and Dr. Nate will talk later, what we're doing more now is the Plavix, we used to hold it 5 days before the procedure, and I think Dr. Nate, we've seen how things have changed. It used to be we would stop it 5 days prior, and then now we've kind of switched it up to we're stopping it maybe the day before, because our abilities, I think, to do the endoscopies have better therapeutic modalities that we can stop, you know, remove a polyp, and if there's post-polypectomy bleeding, we've got better modalities to stop the bleeding. So we're not quite as fearful about having a gastrointestinal bleeding as we are them having a myocardial infarct or having a stroke or something related to us stopping their anticoagulation. Recently we had one of our nurses' dads was going in for his routine colonoscopy not less than a year ago, and sure enough they did stop the Plavix, and it was 5 days prior, and the patient did not have significant risk factor. I can't recall exactly why he was on the Plavix, but he did have a stroke the day before the procedure. So I think this is what we're starting to see now, more an experience that we're less afraid of continuing them on the anticoagulation. We're more afraid of them getting thromboembolic disorders. And if you guys have any questions, feel free to raise your hands. Or if you have any experiences after I'm done with the speak, maybe some cases that you want to discuss that you've had personally, so that we can go back and forth and decide what is the kind of general consensus how to treat these patients. So the timing of the endoscopy, it's interesting, the INRs that they give here, an INR 1.5 to 2.5. I usually like them below 2. But I was out the other night with Dr. Rogelio Silva, one of the gastroenterologists over at Christ Hospital, where they have the external ventricular device. And he said, these patients, we don't even stop their anticoagulation. And you can shed some light on that, because I never see any of these kind of patients. But he said they don't stop the Coumadin at all. They just go in and they take care of the prep and do what they have to do. If it's a patient that's on Coumadin and you want to slowly reverse the anticoagulation, they have either the intravenous form of the vitamin K, or what I prefer to give, depending on how bad their INR is. I mean, if their INR is 10, I'm going to give them a 10 milligram dose at least of vitamin K. Some people like to give the IV, which I think is fine too. The FFP doesn't quite have the rapid effect as the prothrombin complex, but the FFP, from my view, also seems to be safe, and it might be from using it more often and not using the prothrombin complex on a regular basis. But the FFP is good, and again, that depends on the level of the INR and how bad these patients are bleeding. The only one thing that I get concerned about is the amount of volume you have to give. You have to give 6 or 8 units of FFP. So we talked about the types of anticoagulation with the vitamin K antagonists or the warfarin and its reversal agents, vitamin K, FFP, or the prothrombin complex. With the oral anticoagulants, these are amazing how fast their time of onset, and I'll go to it later on at the end of the talk, about how fast these have onset and how many days we want to stop these medications. And again, I kind of look at this as kind of like a Plavix drug, except these just act so much faster and leave the body in a faster period of time. I put in a slide that there was no reversal agent, but we talked about the Pradaxa has a reversal agent. And sometimes for these patients, they can use the prothrombin complex. It has some effect on reversing the effect of these medications. But most of the time, we just sit back and we hope for that the medication to leave the body system and get metabolized and reverse the anticoagulation just from stopping the medication. We can always give blood, right? The post-endoscopic management, I kind of alluded to this earlier, is the Coumadin, I'm really more apt to rapidly start. You could wait days after doing endoscopy if it's just a routine endoscopy and starting the Coumadin. But I usually start it a day or two afterwards. But it depends. You know, if I have a large 5-centimeter, or 4-centimeter, 3-centimeter polyp, I can be a little more cautious. If it's a patient that just has atrial fibrillation, I'm less likely to have jumping on the Coumadin immediately. But if it's a nice polyp that had a stalk on it or some AVMs and those AVMs are well cauterized, then I'm more likely to start the Coumadin sooner than later. And the same thing with the Pradaxa or Eliquis or Plavix, I'm more apt, even though the studies don't have all of this coming through yet, to start these in a more rapid period of time than waiting. The problem is a lot of these with the Coumadin is when you have the mitral valve mechanical valve replacements or the aortic mechanical valve replacements. Those are the real tricky ones because those are the ones that have to be bridged pre-endoscopy, post-endoscopy. Obviously, for the mitral valve replacement, the risk of thromboembolic disorders are pretty severe. And those are the patients that if it's an outpatient mitral valve, mechanical mitral valve replacement patient, and I'm doing even routine endoscopy on them, which I don't know why I don't see as many as I would think, but I usually have them stop the Coumadin, bring them in the hospital 1 to 2 days later, as long as they're following their outpatient INR closely every day. And then I bring them in and put them on intravenous heparin until the day before the procedure. Then we stop it usually the 4 to 5, 6 hours prior. And then depending on what we find during the endoscopy, the day of the endoscopy, starting usually the heparin that night. I think the mitral valve replacement patients are the ones that are most concerning. If it's the aortic valve patient, usually what I'll do is I'll stop the Coumadin as an outpatient, start the Lovenox 3 or 4 days prior to the procedure, stop it usually the night before, because that has a 24-hour half-life, right? And then I'll restart it, usually depending on what we find in that procedure that day. If they just have gastritis or they just have colitis or mild inflammation, I usually don't do a whole heck of a lot about them. And I usually start their heparin or their Lovenox right away. And then usually Coumadin the very next day, because these patients, I don't want to wait around for too long. This is a little busy of a slide. I think Dr. Nate's going to have something about this later. And this is just kind of an overview of what the duration of action was for the aspirin. We all know it's 7 to 10 days for the duration of the action to start and have its effect. The Plavix was down in the middle. It's usually 5 to 7 days. That's why in the old days we would stop this 5 days prior. And the next one, the Coumadin, these are kind of the other ones I'm not really going over too much. Like Aggrastat, we're not going to be that worried about because they're going to be usually in an ICU setting or post-cardiac event. The Coumadin was for 5 days, would be the duration of action. The Lovenox is for up to 24 hours. And the Eliquis, there's a couple more slides and you can refer to these later on. The Eliquis and the Xarelto, these are amazing medications that their effect is within 2 to 4 hours. It's phenomenal. But the only thing, the reason why I put this on here, and I take this into some consideration, but not a huge amount of consideration, is that if they do have significant kidney dysfunction, that this medication is going to stay longer in their body, and some people might stop it a day or two early. Just one caveat about all this stuff, and I was with a group of gastroenterologists the other night. If we have patients that have mitral valve or aortic valve replacements, usually we send them to their cardiologist to just have a second blessing to make sure what we're doing is okay with them. And from a medical legal climate, we see all those things that are going on as far as the advertisements for post-bleeding complications related to a lot of these oral anticoagulants that we don't want to get caught up in that one either. So it's almost safe just to have them see the cardiologist, get their approval. Although some people might be in a more rural setting, it's a little bit more difficult.